What should I say? This is Allen Ginsberg, and you are listening to, or what? You're listening to KGNU 88.5 Boulder, Colorado. And this is Allen Ginsberg, who also listens and talks on KGNU 88.5 Boulder, Colorado.
You're listening to From the Archives to the Air on KGNU. I'm Alexis Kenyon. That was the late, great poet Allen Ginsberg in an outtake from a station identification he recorded for KGNU in 1988. Allen Ginsberg was a key figure in the literary movement that became known as the Beat Generation, and he may be best known for his poem Howl, written in 1955. During his lifetime, he was a frequent visitor to Boulder due to his association with Naropa University, which at the time was still called Naropa Institute. Allen Ginsberg was also a frequent visitor at KGNU. In this episode, we'll hear an archived interview he gave us more than 30 years ago. Here with me is KGNU volunteer John Kellen, who has been going through the archive and pulling material we've heard in the series.
Yeah, hi, Alexis. So Allen Ginsberg was a co-founder, along with Ann Waldman, of Naropa's Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics, and that was in 1974.
A distinctive name.
It is, and according to a Ginsberg biography that I consulted, they debated what to call their poetry department as they formed it in 74. At first, Ann Waldman suggested the Gertrude Stein School. Then she suggested the name it finally got, but they went back and forth over whether to use the word disembodied. The interview that we're about to hear was conducted by KGNU's Chris O'Reilly in 1988, and in it they mentioned that by then the name of the poetry department had been changed to something a little more formal. Then Ginsberg says to Chris, "I think we're going to change it back." And sure enough, they did. I checked the Naropa website, and it is indeed now, or once again, I should say, the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics.
What else is in this episode?
The second part is a 1994 interview with Kerouac biographer Ann Charters.
Okay, and we'll be back to introduce that in a little bit. Now, though, let's hear KGNU's 1988 interview with poet Allen Ginsberg.
Welcome to Naropa 88, our show, a series of shows on visiting faculty members to the summer program at Naropa Institute. My name is Chris O'Reilly. I'll be your host for the next half hour. And joining me here in the studio is poet Allen Ginsberg.
Afternoon.
Afternoon, Allen. How are you doing?
Well, okay. Just got to town yesterday, and I'm still sort of bewildered. And coming with me, I brought a whole group of friends that'll be teaching at Naropa that I sort of took on myself to import.
Aha, and who is that?
Well, one younger poet, Jonathan Robbins, who's a classics major, started at the age of 17 or so. He's now in his 30s, but he made friends with Gregory Corso and myself and William Burroughs and a lot of people around New York who were sort of in advanced stages of bohemian surrealist mentality. And he just sort of ripened and got really interesting and started writing real good poetry and then studied Greek and Latin and teaches classics at Brown. So he's teaching right now this week classics at Naropa, Greek and Latin, along with Peter Lamborn Wilson, who writes sort of exotic novels. And the two of them are covering classic Persian and Greek poetry. Then Harry Smith is in town also, a fabulous recording genius who recorded the first Fugs album, also issued for Folkways back in 1952, a celebrated six-record, three-box set of American folk music, and also did for Folkways the first peyote ceremony, Kiowa peyote ceremony. He's a great bibliophile and writer and filmmaker, so he'll be working, demonstrating his films with Stan Brakhage, who's in town, and he'll be teaching at Naropa as he does at CU. So Harry Smith will be around, and he's a very rare, wise, interesting, old crank. Like one of those brilliant eccentrics that you read about in Days of Yore.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, sounds like you brought quite a few people.
It's going to be a really interesting summer. And Burroughs, William Burroughs will be in town, of course.
Well, you helped start the poetry program at Naropa, didn't you, quite a while ago?
Yeah, well, Ann Waldman and myself in 1974, so it's now 14 years, have been plugging away at it, teaching. Ann and I were co-directors for a long time. Then she went to New York, and I sort of held it single-handed as a director from, I think, 78 to 83. Then I went to New York, and now I'm what's called distinguished professor at Brooklyn College, and Ann is at the wheel of the poetics department at Naropa, formerly known as the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics.
I was disappointed that they changed the name there.
So. I think we'll change it back.
You know, I think that'd be a good idea.
Lowell, Massachusetts, where Senator Tsongas and the local representative to Congress and the mayor and half of the townspeople and all the newspaper people came out for the opening of the Jack Kerouac Memorial Park in the middle of town. And it's really a remarkable accomplishment, a breakthrough for the city to acknowledge him like that.
Yeah, I guess so many people denied who he was for so long. And
well, the funny thing, the great thing was in the newspaper, I think that the headline the day after, peace and honor for Kerouac and Lowell at last. Peace and honor. It was the first time he was so honored.
Yeah.
And the honor is very interesting. What they did was got a sculptor from Texas named Watina to build a series of plinths or granite slabs about 10, 12 feet high in which passages from Kerouac, including complete poems from Mexico City Blues, are incised. So it's a word monument park.
So the complete poems incised on these?
Complete poems incised, and as well as the first and last paragraphs of On the Road on one, and then a little autobiographical page that he wrote for Lonesome Traveler, which was so good that the publishers just printed it on the front page. I think they'd asked him to write some publicity blurb, and he wrote this little prose poem covering his whole life, quoting a little bit from Howell, actually my poem. So that's incised in stone now, his little autobiography, plus passages from Dr. Sachs, which describe local scenes in Lowell, Massachusetts, and from his early novel, The Town and the City, and from... what else? A couple other books. One from his Scripture of Golden Eternity, I think. So it's quite an amazing thing when you go there. It's quite sacred feeling. And it's going to have a great effect on young kids coming in there to get high or whatever they're going to do there. And just sort of sitting around, and there's all this great language coming at them from all sides.
It might inspire them to actually go on the road themselves. You never
well,
know.
It might inspire them to be to look on Earth as sacred, actually. Mm. It's sort of like a sacramental dedication that Kerouac had, and it's transmitted in his language. So any kid from Lowell who's wandering around bored saying he wishes we're in the big city, stumbling into this park, seeing all these words around him, with descriptions of the mills right around his across the river, across the canal, that are visible, described in words and at the same time visible on the spot, it's going to kind of sacramentalize the scene for those kids. Better than going on the road, even. Though I'm sure if any kid there, you know, reads it, he'll be inspired to some, like,
right,
more universal mind than a chauvinistic Massachusetts mind.
I think that's good they finally did that for him.
Oh, yeah, it was terrific. I had a photograph show that opened there. And then we had a big reading with Robert Creeley from Buffalo, Michael McClure, and Ray Manzarek, who used to be Manzarek playing along with McClure.
Right.
McClure was sort of the guru for Jim Morrison, and Manzarek was his musician.
Right.
I always talked a little bit about Kerouac and then read poems related to him.
So,
have to rename the school, Jack Kerouac School, of embodied poetry.
Right.
Of monumental poetry.
I wish you would.
Again, yeah, well, I always liked it. Once we got accredited, once Naropa was accredited, everybody got a little bit straighter, but we might bend over back, bend backward again. You know, the poetics program was quite brilliant, but underfunded all these years, and so we had to do the best we can, everybody working sort of free, or for less, you know, a very small amount. Like I make, you know, tens and tens and tens and tens and tens of thousands as a professor in Brooklyn, and Europa can hardly afford anything, but I think the teaching here is greater and the program is greater, actually. So finally it's sort of off the ground and accredited, and with the MFA program there's enough students to keep the ball rolling real well now.
You just have to keep going.
Well, Chögyam Trungpa, the Tibetan Lama who founded Naropa, he did it on the basis of a 100-year plan. He said it'll take 100 years to set roots in America for this kind of education, a contemplative, sacred education, sort of not strictly religious, but sacramental, like Kerouac's attitude toward Lowell, seeing the earth as a sacred place.
So how does meditation and Buddhism affect your poetry?
Well, that's what I'll be lecturing on tonight, actually. Uh-huh. Tonight's contemplative, and I'll be dealing with imagist poetics. Poetry, say, by William Carlos Williams, Charles Reznikoff, Blaise Cendrars, up to Gregory Corso, where you have precision of observation, where you notice what you notice, where you observe what's vivid. When you realize that vividness is self-selecting, so that the first vivid thought is the best thought. First thought, best thought is our slogan. Hmm. Naturally, first vivid thought. When you catch yourself thinking, would be the slogans. Notice what you notice, catch yourself thinking, observe what's vivid, and rest and relax in the fact that vividness is self-selecting, so you don't have to make anything up. So that would be like... say, in Gregory Corso, on the walls of a dull-furnished room, I hang old photos of my childhood girls. With breaking heart I sit, elbow on table, chin on hand, studying the proud eyes of Helen, the weak mouth of Jane, the golden hair of Susan. So he noticed the weak mouth of Jane, which most poets wouldn't have wanted to write down. They would want to romanticize it. But he said, the weak mouth of Jane. Or... this little poem, this is early Corso. Mm-hmm. Mrs. Lombardi's month-old son is dead. I saw it in Rizzo's funeral parlor, a small, purplish, wrinkled head. They've just finished having high mass for it. They're coming out now. Wow, such a small coffin and 10 black Cadillacs to haul it in. Of course, that's strictly New York, Italian district, Italian extravaganza. So that's sort of almost like... photographic, in a sense.
I would like to read something of yours.
Well, yeah, I have some...
Is that a new book?
Well, this is a book that came out this last year. Uh-huh. It's called White Shroud, Poems 1980 to 85. It takes a year to put it all together and cook it up and make a soup out of it, and then it comes out in the book in 86 and
right.
87, and time for another book any minute. Well... this is a little poem that's, you might say, photographic, because that's my preoccupation this week. This week it's sort of the basis, the ground or practical poetics, you know, direct sight, eye, real world. Next week we'll take it off on a lift off onto the surrealist level, where you mix up dream, imagination, accident, cut up, fantasy. Hmm. But in order to do surrealism right, you have to be able to have command of particular detail from real world.
You have to have the foundation set up.
Yeah. So this is actually an exercise. I was in China, was ill, was in bed for several days, and finally I got up in this new town I was in, Baoding, and I took a walk out of my dormitory down the block. And so this is called One Morning I Took a Walk in China. So this is what you'd see if you get up and take a walk in a small town in China. One morning I took a walk in China. Students danced with wooden silvered swords, twirling on hard-packed muddy earth as I walked out Hebei University's concrete north gate. Across the road, a blue-capped man sold fried sweet dough sticks, brown as new-boiled donuts in the gray light of sky. Past poplar trees, whitewashed cylinders topped with red bands the height of a boy. Children with school satchels sang and walked past me. Donkeys in the road. One big, one dwarf, pulling ahead of his brother, hauled a cart of white stones. Another donkey dragged a load of bricks. Others, baskets of dirt. Under trees at the crossing, vendors set out carts and tables of cigarettes. Mandarin tangerines, yellow round pearl pears taste crunchy, lemony, strange. Apples, yellow, red, pink. Short bananas, half-blacked, green. Few bunches of red grapes and trays of peanuts, glazed thumb-sized crab apples, six on a stick. Soft, wrinkled yellow persimmons sat dozens spread on a cloth in wet mud by the curb. Cook pots on charcoal near corner side tables, noodle broth vegetables sprinkled on top. A white-headed barber shook out his ragged towel, mirror hung on a red nail in the brick wall. Where a student sat, black hair clipped at the ears straight across the back of his neck. Soft, gritty coal pellets lay drying on the sidewalk, and down the factory alley, more black mats spread, long green cabbages heaped by the building side waiting for the home pot, or stacked on hand tractor carts the market veranda a few yards away, leeks in a pile, bright orange carrots thick and rare, green unripe tomatoes, parsley, thin celery stalks, awful cheap, potatoes and fish, little and big heads chopped or alive in a tub, tiny fresh babies or aged carp in baskets, a half pig on a slab, two trotters stick out, a white burlap shroud covered his body cleft in half, meat of the ox going through a grinder, white fat red muscle and sinew together squeezed into human spaghetti, bicycles lined up along the concrete walk, trucks pull in and move out delivering cows, dead and fresh green-stalked salad, down street, the dry goods store, the dry goods door, soap, pencils, notebooks, tea, fur coats lying on the counter, strawberry jam in rusty iron-topped jars, milk powder, dry cookies with sweetmeats inside dissolve on the tongue to wash down fragrant black tea. Ah, the machine shop gateway, brick-walled latrine inside the truck yard. Enter, squat on a brick and discharge your earth, or stand and pee in the big hole filled with pale, brown, squishy droppings an hour before. Out, down the alleyway across the street, a factory's giant smokestack. Black cloud fumes boiling into the sky, gray-white with mist. I couldn't see that chimney a block away. Coming home, past women on bicycles heading downtown, their noses and mouths covered with white cotton masks. So that's sort of like almost photographically descriptive, like a little cinema walk down the street in China.
Now I know what it's like to be in China.
Yeah, that was the idea. Uh-huh. You get a little glimpse of the surprise, of, you know, like what's really there in the little tiny details of notice what's vivid, watch yourself, catch yourself thinking, notice what you notice.
Well, how does this compare with the surrealistic type poetry? I mean, this is more of a photographic type poetry.
Yeah. Well, it's the grounding. All right. But if you're going to write, say, about castles in the air, you still have to paint bricks and granite slabs drawbridges and pennants and soldiers marching up and down with muskets or samurai armor.
So you just observe yourself fantasizing or whatever.
Right. Yeah, I think probably the best fantasy is that which has come naturally and then you notice it later. You know, like everybody fantasizes, what's the end of the universe? And if I shoot up there on an elastic band, will I find it made, the wall of the universe made out of rubber, or will it be made out of brick, or will it be made out of iron? And even if that's the end of the universe and there's a wall there, if it's rubber, brick, and iron, it must be something beyond the wall, because there couldn't be anything, nothing beyond it.
Right, right.
So everybody's had that fantasy. So it's a question of describing what you saw in your head, I think. This white shroud book I just mentioned actually has, as its central poem, a dream. A dream about my mother. And in the book, there's another dream called Black Shroud. And they're, in a sense, surrealist, because they're recombinations of naturalistic detail that suddenly give you a strange, garish, visionary moment. I'll read you a couple lines from this. In this, I'm walking in the middle of New York, in the West Bronx, and I suddenly notice an old shopping bag lady, and I describe her at great length, and her little corner where she's got her bags and her pot and everything like that, her cooking pot and her moth-eaten rabbit fur hat. then I, and it's actually my mother, and I noticed it's my mother later. But meanwhile, I was horrified a little to take care of such a woman, familiar, half neglected on the street, except she'd weathered many snows, stubborn, alone in her moth-eaten rabbit fur hat. She had tooth troubles, teeth too old, ground down like horse molars. She opened her mouth to display her gorge. How can she live with that? How eat, I thought. Mushroom-like, gray-white horseshoe of incisors she chomped with. Hard, flat flowers ranged round her gums. Then I recognized she was my mother, Naomi, etc. So it's just a sudden, you know, dream-like moment when, you know, like, the mouth opens up and becomes 1,000 miles large, and these strange flat teeth chomped down like horse molars. You know, you're going along in a normal, naturalistic storyline, and all of a sudden, it's like a magnifying glass opens up, and some weird detail becomes enormous and gigantic, like in Alice in Wonderland.
Mm.
So the surrealism rises out of natural detail, but it's sort of like the mind recombining nature into an imaginative structure. And dreams are sort of stable structures for surrealist expansion.
Mm-hmm.
Fantasy is. Or it can be done mechanically by simply taking word passages and chopping them up with a razor or a scissors, and then recombining the pieces and seeing what falls out by accident. Like, I remember Burroughs did this many years ago. He was doing it around the early 60s. And I remember he suggested I try it. So during the Bay of Pigs crisis, I took the Russian official government pronouncement about what happened, and I took Kennedy's speech and cut them up with the scissors out of the New York Times and recombined them. And the first line was, "The purpose of these exercises is warlike maneuvers." it brought out the hidden substrate.
More true than what any of them were saying at the time.
Yeah. Well, they were covering it over. Mm-hmm. Cutting it up brought out the sort of subtext.
Would you like to read another one?
Mine? Or let's see. I think what I would like to read is from what I'll be teaching tonight, because I got to prepare for my class. This is a good way of doing it as any. In a half an hour, I'll be up there yakking away. This is the combination of the two. An early surrealist, Blaise Cendrars, who made up surrealist poems by taking pieces out of the newspaper and doctoring them a little, and each poem is like a tiny little newspaper story, but all of a sudden with its weird twist, or as if, you know, a travelogue. This is called The Mockingbird. These are called Postcards from the Americas. These are Frenchmen. This is 1920 or so. 1918. The Mockingbird. Sweltering heat. A balcony shaded with trumpet creeper and purple honeysuckle. In the deep silence of the slumbering countryside, you can hear the gurgling of small rushing streams, the distant lowing of large herds of cattle in the pastures, the song of the nightingale, the crystal clear hissing of gigantic toads, screeching nocturnal birds of prey, and the mockingbird chirping in the cacti. Okay, so that's actually naturalistic. And the mockingbird chirping in the cacti. Or I don't know if it is naturalistic, but it's actually surrealist when you think a mockingbird chirping in the cacti.
Right.
Partly it's the sound, the mockingbird chirping in the cacti, which is so odd. Partly it's the facts set side by side. A mockingbird and cacti, you don't think of a mockingbird. You think of the mockingbird, you know, in Magnolia or something. And a mockingbird chirping in the cacti. Pretty funny. I like him. Surrealist, but at the same time it's clearly American reality. There was one very funny one called Work. Sort of the Far West, a sort of French version of the Far West, but it's also natural. Work. Racketeers have just blown out the bridge on the elevated runway. Carriages have caught fire at the bottom of the valley. The wounded are weltering in the scalding hot water spouting out of the smashed engine. Living torches run through the debris and steam jets. Other carriages are left hanging 200 feet high. Men armed with electric and acetylene torches walk down the path of the valley, and help is organized with silent speed. In the shelter of rushes, reeds, and willows, the aquatic birds are all in a flutter. Dawn tarries. That already a team of 100 carpenters called in by telegram and bought by special train are busy with the reconstruction of the bridge. Bang, 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 hand me the nails. Sort of the slit. Bang, 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 hand me the nails is sort of the end of it.
Well, time goes too fast around here, I tell you, and just about out of time. You'll be doing a reading for us at KGNU, a benefit.
I'll be doing that benefit. It'll be just myself reading, I think. Is there anybody else on that program? I don't think so.
As far as I know, it's just you.
So that'll give me a chance to spread out, and I'll probably be with Stephen Taylor as musical accompanist, and also be having a poetry performance on July 10th, earlier, with Ann Waldman and Stephen Taylor over at Naropa. But in this case, I'll be able to spread out and really sort of read a lot.
Is there still time for students to go down and register for courses at Naropa?
Yes, they just began now. Sure. And there's still lots coming with Anselm Hollow. Art Landy and Jerry Grinnelli and Mark Miller are also going to be playing music. Mamie Bressenbrugge and Fielding Dawson, I hadn't mentioned, also will be on hand teaching and reading. Marian Faithful will be with Fernando Saunders, her steady bass player.
You were trying to get her on the show also.
Yeah, she should be there. Kenwood Elmsley, a great Gaga New York playwright, will be there putting on an opera called with the Cafe Bimbo Lounge. There'll be poetry and opera later on in July. They'll be dancing with Nancy Stark Smith, Simon Forty, and Anne will be dancing. And then, of course, William Burroughs at the end of our program, and then the special benefit for KGNU on July 26th.
That sounds like a good program.
Yeah, we'll have a great time this summer. Right.
Well, thanks a lot for coming down, Alan.
Thank you for hosting us.
That was KGNU's Chris O'Reilly talking with poet Allen Ginsberg in 1988.
KGNU FM 88.5 Boulder. KGNU 1390 Denver.
Part two of today's From the Archives to the Air is a 1994 interview with Ann Charters, author of the first Jack Kerouac biography. John, can you tell us a little bit about this?
Yes. So Ann Charters is a scholar of beat literature. She's a lit professor at the University of Connecticut. At the time of the interview, she had just completed one volume and was working on a second of a collection of Kerouac correspondence. The interview is by Ann Waldman and Sam Fuqua, and they talk in detail about those collected letters. And in fact, the interview begins with Charters reading one of them.
Anything else?
Yes, I also came across something in the archive here that was just too good to leave out. It's a recording of Ann Waldman reading a poem of hers called Curse. And this segment begins with it. It's pretty short, but listeners should know, no need to adjust your volume. She begins reading very softly, but it builds in intensity.
Okay, thanks, John. Let's go then to poet Ann Waldman reading Curse.
Curse. You loathsome, miserable, draconian TV patriarchs, obsolete senators, questionable House of Reps, lie of the land admirals, perjuring lieutenant colonels, dishrag attorney generals, namby-pamby political Pentecostals, macho drug smugglers, killer arms dealers, consultant traffickers in blood money, multi-million dollar fraud Pentagon schemers, techno-military-industrial complex, corrupt wed-tech lowlifes, warring god-realm destroyers! Shut off! Not a woman amongst ya! Ye lily-livered, walloping big wheels, judges of my world! I'll make your semen dry up. Your genitalia will wither in the wind.
I think I'm going to read a letter that Kerouac wrote to William S. Burroughs in mid-May 1955 from his sister's house in Rocky Mount, North Carolina. Kerouac in 1959 was at the peak of his form as a writer of spontaneous prose. And a few months after this, he was going to be awarded a $200 grant that was going to keep him in Mexico City long enough to create his best book of blues called Mexico City Blues. But in mid-May 1955, he didn't know he'd ever have enough money to go back to Mexico. He's poor, living in his sister's house. And out of a complete desperation, he writes a letter to William Burroughs. The first page is missing, but then it goes on like this. Myself, of course, in desperation, I'm drinking moonshine cocktails or punch made with orange juice, ice, ginger ale, and white lightning. Very good. Every time exhilarating, yet never heavy like wine or even hangover making. What's to do? It always seemed to me that ennui was my worst enemy. Starving to death on the road many times, at least I was interested, looked forward to eating. But ennui, oh, ennui, it's just too much. And this is one of those times when I would just love to sit and let you talk and be amused and try to amuse you, like an old Bill Gilmore of time, like Kells, talking about your guns in the bedroom high on H. Alan keeps writing me dull accounts of nothing in San Francisco, says he's tired, tired. I'm not even going out there as I planned, but if I do, I'll be a drunk there. Better not go. I miss New York, the big excitement of ball games and bars, beer, village, seeing Stanley Gould, long walks on the moonlight May waterfront with pint of wine alone, or French movie. Here I am, in the heart of the cotton fields and tobacco fields, bored. Of course, in the middle of the night, when the orange moon sheds dips from big glory clouds and you don't hear even a dog bark, and I sit in dark yard in white chair with drink. But I'd rather be in the native quarter of Tangiers with you, I tell you. I'd like to be there high on hash, writing City, City, City copy of short story version of which I'm sending you for your pleasure. This is the story I think we should collaborate on for a full novel, making the first truly literarily valuable book written by two men together instead of Mutiny on the Bounty. A real wild one. I think you have there the basic scene for many hilarious satires, your kind and my kind. This present short story version I hope to publish, but it's nothing to do with the eventual novel that I would like to see produced by the two of us in Tangiers or wherever you'll be. By William Lee and Jean-Louis. What say? You'll give me a good reason to go to Tangiers and get high on hash. Read it, send it back, and let me know what you think. I'm waiting for word from Bob Giroux, who said he wanted to see my new Buddhist full-length book, Buddha Tells Us. A Lake of Light, it is. Direct quotes from scriptures, some mix, some my own words. My, who owns words? And by God, it is a lake of light, designed for to be clear to Westerners. Buddhism is not for the West. Only means Buddhism is not for Alan Anson, Bill Burroughs, and Jack Kerouac. But let it go at that. I'd rather see Buddhism than D.H. Lawrence and his Dylan Thomas and Reich and idiots. Now I'm drunk, can't type. Bill, I wrote you a letter by hand in February, but had no 15 cents for overseas airmail, so I sent it to Alan for forwarding. In other words, Bill, you owe me a letter. Something must have gone wrong. Just so you'll know I don't neglect writing. Curious to know what you're doing and writing these days. Send me something bulky to match the bulky City, City, City manuscript. Whatever happened to Anson? Where is Kells now? How are you feeling? Alan's definitely going to Europe next year after Christmas. Hope I can go with him. Damn it, if these people would only pay me for my genius. Did you see New World Writing number 7 with my story by Jean-Louis in it? Wild. Guess who I saw in the village? Wig Walters, a serious jazz artist, and wailing on bass with a gang of new musicians who are the wave of the future in Cafe Bohemia. Later in the Riviera New Bar, Anton Rosenberg was panning my New World Writing story. What a bunch of thieves and rats. Finally, everyone ran out on me, and I stood laughing alone in the night, no longer a hero. Finally, I went to Tony Pastor's and watched the belly dancers with the sailors. We were all properly reverent. I realized I have no sex. your prophecy and junkie of sexless American heroes. Sexless ain't no hero. No, hero-less sex not. Ah, Willie, make me happy. Drop me a note. Sure than hell we'll get high together again in the fellaheen room night with Daves of other cultures and with new visions of our own American story. You old hero of mine, Jack.
Wonderful.
That's a pretty good letter.
That's a very good letter.
Of course, what Burroughs is doing, he has no need of Jack. I mean, at this point, he's in Tangier writing Naked Lunch. And finally, you know, he sent him a letter, an answer another month later. He gets the answer from Burroughs, and he says, you know, like, you can develop City yourself, stay in America, and we're happy to look at the rest of it. Send it to me as you go along. But Kerouac was so broke, he really didn't have the money for postage stamps. Or even get 15 cents for the postage stamp.
The sweet yearning.
Yeah, the sweet yearning. Exactly. And the sense of the companionship.
I know I'm feeling in isolation.
Right, exactly. Somebody on his wavelength, but so far away. And he really is, you know, in just 6 months going to be in Berkeley with Alan in the Milvia
That's
College.
Right.
And there's going to be the six gallery reading, and it's all going to blow sky high, and life will never quite be the same. And you don't get any sense of that. You get the sense of Kerouac just not really understanding that there'll ever be a respite for this loneliness and poverty. So
Little did he know.
This is a book that I put together, the Selected Letters 1940 to 1956, to show Kerouac as he really was, that all these great books he wrote, the true story novels about his own life, don't really develop the main idea of his life, which is that he's a writer.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
And the letters are the other half. They show
and
him
a lot of them
as
predate the explosion.
Yes.
And the myth.
Yes.
And
well, the real explosion, sadly enough, will come with Volume 2, 1957 to 69, because the beginning of Volume 2 is his finally signing the contract with Viking Press to publish On the Road. It's published in September of 57.
That's right.
And his life will really change at that point.
Curious about how you attacked the whole letters project, and was some of the high moments there or difficult times? You read last summer that wonderful letter to Norma Blichfeld, which you had discovered.
Yes. That's right. In the archives that Kerouac himself had kept. No, when I worked with him on his bibliography in August 1966 in Hyannis, he showed me his archive. I was just looking at the printed material, but he showed me his manuscripts and his letters, and he had kept everything in manila folders with rubber bands or pieces of string to tie things together. Meticulously kept archives. And after his death, his widow kept everything in cold storage so that it was room temperature, it was, you know, archivally correct. And when her estate was probated and the ownership of the material went on to her youngest brother, John Sampas, and the rest of the Sampas family, I was approached by John to edit the letters, and I had seen a lot of them in archives, but of course I'd never seen what Kerouac had in his own bedroom archive. And that was a real discovery, finding not only that he had carbons of letters that he'd written to Cassidy, he kept carbons of anything
Amazing.
He typed.
Amazing.
But he had letters that he'd written and never sent to early girlfriends like Norma Blichfeld from the 1940s. And even more astonishing to me was that all the Sampas family had kept his letters to Sebastian Sampas, who was his earliest friend in Lowell when he was still in high school and when he went off to college.
After he died.
Well, yes. What happened was that Sebastian was in the army, and when Jack sent him a letter, Sebastian sent it home to his sister Stella for safekeeping. And Stella kept all the letters from Sebastian, that Sebastian had gotten from Kerouac. And the letters that he'd written during the war, the Sampas family knew about. But apparently Stella Sampas had kept the most precious letters, which were the ones to her dead brother, and the ones he'd written her all through the time that he was traveling.
How wonderful.
He kept writing back to Stella as a sort of link between him and Sebastian. And Stella had these in a box under her bed. She gave them to Tony, her brother Tony, who, as I was midway in the book, thinking that the letters really started at 1941 with the letter to his sister, suddenly John Sampas calls me and says he's real sorry, but there's even earlier material.
Oh my goodness.
Because Tony just brought over another box of the Sampas family Kerouac letters. And of course, the biggest thrill of all, I mean, you asked the high point, was seeing the postcards that Jack sent
his
mother
yes.
while he went for the first time on the road, on the road to Denver. And he writes her these amazing postcards that you or I could have written our mothers. They're so un-Kerouacian.
He's writing them every day.
He's dropping them in the mail. And he refers to them in On the Road. But on the other hand, they are...
To his aunt.
That's right, yeah. To his aunt. But he's saying things like, well, I read you one, okay? May I
yeah,
do that?
Very,
really, they're just so very short. And they're from 1947, Jack's first trip from the East Coast to visit Neil Cassady in Denver. And his mother's real worried about him. You know, you can understand her baby boy has left home. So July 24th, 1947, in Shelton, Nebraska, "Dear Ma," says Jack, "I've been eating apple pie and ice cream all over Iowa and Nebraska, where the food is so good. We'll be in Colorado tonight, and I'll write you a letter from Denver. Everything fine, money holding out. Love, Jackie. XXX. P.S. You ought to see the cowboys out here." That's the postcard. It's a penny postcard, and I had it in my hand. You know, like, I couldn't believe it. This is, you know, Sal Paradise writing his aunt. So anyway, there was a lot of good feeling in the book. And when I came to make the final cut, because I knew the book had to be a one-volume edition, I found that I would use half of what I had, and I thought I could make the volume. But then as I began working on it, it was clear that the letters that I felt were essential were really going to be enough for a one volume, and they would stop in 1956. I need really two volumes to do the minimum
of
essential
course,
job. Yeah. And the shaping of the book was always to tell the life that Jack lived mm-hmm. as fully in every detail as possible. So I selected letters that covered the high spots of his private life, and especially centering on his development as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
So if I didn't use something, it was because it had been repeated in an earlier letter, or it wasn't covering a period of his life that I felt you should hear mm-hmm. about because it was instrumental in how he turned to be the writer that he was.
I love your commentary before
oh,
each letter.
You.
That really works and holds the book together.
Yeah, there was a good volume of, for example, Burroughs' letters without commentary published recently, and that was okay because most of it is addressed to Alan. So
exactly.
You have the same person and you have the same concerns being exchanged. But with the Kerouac letters, I could use not only the archives, I could use, to tell Jack's life story, letters to all these different friends, and I found that it was really hard to follow the different people that he was writing unless you had a little bit of background
yeah,
commentary.
I think it's really useful.
Thank
also,
you.
How did you choose the, for example, his mother's letters to him and Sebastian Sampas? I mean, was
okay,
that...
Okay, everything I... Like, as in the Beat Reader, when I edited
right.
that, everything has been done for many reasons. I think any good anthology is, you know, reflects lots of concerns. But for me, I wanted certain people to say important things to you. And also, from a woman's point of view,
mm-hmm,
that perspective, especially in the Kerouac Reader, was involved in my selection of material in the Reader. But for the letters, for example, I wanted you to know that Kerouac's friends, while they supported his writing, were not uncritical. So I wanted one letter by each of the important friends to be in there so that you can get a sense of the exchange of the writer, the correspondence. And with Alan's letter to Jack putting down the revision of On the Road as what was later published as Visions of Cody, I wanted you to see that his friends were tough.
If
he wrote something and they didn't like it, they didn't mince around about it. They told him so. The letter from Cassady, well, that was one of my female woman's concerns. I put that one in because, first of all, the Beat Reader has the great Cassady correspondence.
Yeah, yeah.
But I wanted, in this case, to show what the appeal was for Cassady to settle down with Carolyn.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Jack never made a home for himself with any of his wives until his
exactly.
mother was ill and had to, you know, marry Stella. But with the letter from Neil, it isn't the greatest letter in the world, and so I quote one of the great ones, which Carolyn generously let me do, and how it really shaped Jack's thoughts toward writing, and that's mm-hmm, after the one that I quoted for Carolyn's sake. I didn't discuss this with Carolyn.
Could I get just a little clarification on Carolyn?
Sure. Neil Cassady, of course, who was Sal Paradise's accomplice in On the Road, Dean Moriarty was the character, was the character of Camille Moriarty. Carolyn Cassidy was the wife of Neil Cassidy. And when I was compiling the book of letters, I was doing part of the work in the year I was in London and seeing her a lot. And she had Xeroxes of everything from Texas. The University of Texas at Austin, there's a huge humanities center. And the Cassidy-Kerouac-Ginsburg correspondence is there. So you get permission from them if you want to quote anything. But Carolyn had all the material in London. And while she generously gave me everything, I decided to use that letter, which was Neil telling Jack what a great person she was, that he was going to marry her. Because, as I said, I wanted to establish the fact that Neil had the courage to get married and stay married, but Jack kept passing it by. Anyway, the same thing happens in Volume 2. One of his great friendships was with John Cleland Holmes. And in 1965, when Holmes originally proposed the idea of a reader to Kerouac, he had no ideas, Holmes, about how to put the reader together. He never really thought it that far. But he did have an idea of interviewing Kerouac to find out about his background as a writer. And there's an incredible, like, long letter where Holmes asks the questions and Kerouac answers them. And I've got permission from the Holmes estate to use that in Volume 2. And I hope that we get to see a Volume 2. So,
have you started work on that?
Well, it's a complicated thing. Uh-huh. I've started work, but
it's a lot harder.
It's an awful lot of work, and it's not a happy book. Mm-hmm. Because Kerouac is already an alcoholic when the book opens. And none of my commentary dwell on the fact that he's always drinking. The letter I just finished reading, for example, he talks about the beginning of the letter, what he's drinking, and then he says, I'm drunk. But there's so much incredible stuff in that letter, you sort of don't think about it.
Exactly.
And if you read every letter carefully, he's telling you the extent of his whatever he's on at the moment. And it adds up to a life of addiction, basically. And alcohol is drug of choice. And by 1957, he's really over the edge where he can control it. And, for example, when he goes in the early, I think, three letters into the second volume, he's signing the contract with Cowley for On the Road. Malcolm Cowley was his editor. And he goes to the Viking offices, takes a bus up from Florida, where he's living with his mother and sister, and gets off the bus and goes directly to the Viking offices with a half pint of bourbon in his pocket. And in the elevator, probably on an empty stomach, off the bus, he chug-a-lugs the bourbon. And so he appears before Malcolm Cowley and signs the contract. But I imagine Malcolm Cowley was, you know, like he had his own response to that. So that's going to set the tone of the second volume. And then it goes downhill. But anyway.
Were you surprised at all at just in this brief conversation, everyone seems to have saved everything?
Yes. The image of the beat writers are these wild, irresponsible.
Throwing things over their shoulders.
Exactly. In the heat of inspiration and spontaneity, keeping nothing, you know, writing it on the wind, as it were. No, that is not true for Jack Kerouac. I won't speak for other archives.
Alan is a pack rat.
But I have a feeling, yes, that Alan is the same and probably Burroughs is too. This was the thing that surprised me most when I worked with Kerouac in 66, that he had it all. And that with his mother's help, without her, there would have been no sense of him as a, quote, real writer. You know, like, have you a real poet? Did you write those yourself? And he did slave on his writing, and he also had very high ambition for himself. He wanted to be the American Joyce or the American Proust, no less than that, which means that you keep a meticulous archive, and you do chart the progress of your development as a writer. So the books, for the first time, especially the letters, illustrate that care.
And the mother is such an extraordinary figure with all that.
Right. Now, one of the letters from her that I put in the book was the one after he married his first wife, Jack, and for the first time she, quote, lost, unquote, her son. And her response is sort of, well, she's still got her husband alive then, so it's not quite so traumatic, but their bond was extraordinary. They were very close. But she writes to Jack, living with Edie Parker in Chicago or wherever in the Midwest, you know, that she wishes him well in his marriage and is sure that he will be a great writer. His dream will come true. And I thought that was such a generous, and it I really wanted, is. That was the letter I mm-hmm. wanted most in that
yeah,
book.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Publishing collected letters of any author is seems to be a logical step in establishing their place in the literary canon. Just your thoughts on that, and how has this been viewed in the world of letters?
Well, let's just say that the first review we got for these two books before publication was from the Journal of Contemporary Fiction, which is an academic journal, and it was very respectful. In fact, it was very high. It was a wonderful review. I hope that Jack Kerouac will be accepted as the equal, at least, of John Steinbeck and possibly of Malcolm Cowley in the canon of recent American writers. And there's no better way to do it, as you say, than establishing the fact that he was a serious writer by selected letters.
We must get at least two calls a week at the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics from young high school students who are writing papers on the Beat Generation, teachers, college students who are talking about how do you read this mm-hmm. kind of thing, mm-hmm. Interviews. I did some Wonderful. Interviews last week, and Radio Canada called. What is this Beat phenomena? Your book is in all, everybody
Wonderful.
Has your book.
Wonderful.
The one class was going, they were spending a whole semester using your Beat Reader. And they had spent a week on the Gallery 6 reading alone, sort of acting it out. And
that's what it was meant to do. You can do that now.
It's very interesting that so many young people my son's age, my son is 14 and he's already written a paper on the Howell trial.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
That was in eighth grade, are very excited by the work.
Well, as you can see from the really inspired letters, not the postcard to his mother, you know, the penny postcard, you got a penny's worth, but the 15-cent airmail stamp version of it, actually 8 years later to Burroughs, is a mature Kerouac, you know, style. And it's also, in essence, a miniature story. He was a magnificent storyteller, and all the letters are little stories. You know, like, I'm starting out drunk, and then I'm so lonely here. I'm sending you a story. I hope we can go together to work on it. This is what's happening, you know, with all my friends around me. I'm so lonely. I really can't write anymore because I'm drunk, and I hope everything's okay with you. I mean, beautifully organized. And he didn't sit down and outline the letter. He just had a sense of form, you know, in everything he touched.
Innate
form, exactly. So you can see that in the letters. But when he is describing something that he just sort of does a treatment of a page and a half or so in a personal letter, when he actually expands it into a novel, then you can see what he does is rely on memories, what the associations are of the event, much more to get the emotive feel of the event, to recreate it for you. Again, not to tell you so much as show you about it.
Could I ask you, just both of you, and before we wrap up, this a sort of generic question that you mentioned, the Beat phenomena, and it living in Boulder, I think, you know, with this, the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics and the Rope Institute being a fact of our community, I don't have a sense of a resurgence in America because you're here and mm-hmm. and noticeable and prominent and keeping it in front of us here in Boulder. Talk a little bit more about this phenomena, if it really is one, and or is it just some kind of a media concoction?
Well, I think it has to do with the times, certainly the end of this century. We're back in some ways back in the 50s from some points of view. You know, the political climate, the sort of doldrums you felt there. I think for younger people, it's exciting to go to this work in that period and have these Beat literary focus culture heroes, because they were expansive, experimental, traveling, trying things, expanding their minds, the sense of camaraderie, community, support, which you do not find in this more competitive consumerist world that's gotten more, you know, more extreme.
No, my sense of it is the same as yours about the times being the way they are. And I also feel that Kerouac never really ever went away. I mean, his books have been continuously in print. You can never find them in the used bookstores. People just don't resell them. But I do know that sales of On the Road in particular have reached the 100,000 copies a year category, which is a very large number. It's as much as the Grapes of Wrath sell in paper every year. And Kerouac's On the Road maybe sold 40,000 copies like 5 years or 6 years ago. Then it sold 70,000 a few years ago. And now it's up to 100,000. In May, they're coming out with Kerouac's own manuscript, Book of Blues, which he prepared for publication but was never published. And then early in 96, they're coming out with two of his Buddha books, which is Wake Up, the biography of the Buddha that's been running in Tricycle magazine, and Sum of the Dharma, which is his book of Buddhist sutras that he translated from French. So he's got a major press behind him. And packaging the books the way he wanted them to be packaged as part of the uniform series of novels comprising the story of his life. These marvelous photographic covers with strips of negatives with the people inside on the covers of new packaging for Dharma Bums or On the Road.
You've been listening to KGNU's 1994 interview with author and beat literature scholar Ann Charters in conversation with poet Anne Waldman and KGNU's Sam Fuqua. This has been KGNU's From the Archives to the Air, created from content drawn from our audio archive. Most of it hasn't been heard since its original broadcast. We hope that listeners find it interesting, culturally significant, and even relevant. From the Archives to the Air is written and produced by John Kellen and me, Alexis Kenyon. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.